Beautiful people, welcome to Love Babs Love Talk. I'm Babs Rawls Ivy. It is Friday, and hooray, we got through another week. So I'm delighted today to have a friend of mine who happens to be the president and CEO of United Way of Greater New Haven, Jennifer Heath, because they, in partnership with the Community Foundation, are doing some things around this COVID-19 that I think bears sharing with the community at this point, because they've been sharing this information. They pivoted, they were ready to take on this virus. And the last time that I saw her, we were celebrating the United Way's 100th anniversary. And so now Here we are talking about another worldwide pressing issue. How are you?
Hi, Babs. It is so good to see you.
It's good to see you, even under these crazy circumstances.
I know. I'm doing okay, thanks. Everybody's healthy, so that's good. And we're adjusting to all being home.
Yes. How many kids do you have, Jennifer?
I have a son and a stepson, both teenagers.
Okay. Yeah. So there's not a whole lot of entertaining you need to do. Probably more refereeing.
Yeah, a little bit of refereeing. And I don't know how my colleagues and friends who have small children and are trying to also work from home are doing it right now.
Yeah, I don't, girl. I'm so out that game. Every time I see it and hear it, I feel very blessed that I'm out of that zone, that age zone, you know. Yeah. But God bless parents who have to do it. So you got to do it.
Sure. That is for sure. Stressful times.
So the last time I saw you, Jennifer, we were all involved in talking about the United Way's 100th anniversary.
We were moving forward. I know. You know, it's so yes, 2020 is our 100th anniversary year. It is still our 100th anniversary year, but as you might expect, we are not focused on that right now.
No.
We've completely kind of put that to the side. I kind of said jokingly, if the Olympics can move a year, we can just move our 100th to next year, right? So we'll probably celebrate being 101. And it's also interesting thinking about the fact that so many references have been made to the Spanish flu, you know, epidemic that was in 1918. Yes. So that was right before the United Way was actually founded in 1920.
Wow, that's amazing.
So that feels like an odd thing to be 100 years later having kind of some similar conversations about what's going on in the community.
Yes, that is amazing, because I know they had to have caught got thrown right in the midst of that, and I'm sure that had a lot to do with really solidifying why you all were founded.
Yeah, I don't remember. I mean, looking at some of those old articles about the founding, I don't remember specific references to that, but I have to imagine it was on people's minds, you know, having lived through that and seeing what a need there was in the community and realizing they needed a way to respond collectively. And so I'm really, I'm sorry for the situation that we're all experiencing today, because I know what kind of impact it's having on people, both in terms of people's health, but also their economic well-being. I mean, these are just, and mental well-being. I mean, there are so many far-reaching impacts. And so, as I said, we've just completely switched gears. We're not doing anything around our 100th, and we're focused on how can we be helpful to the community given the crisis that we're in right now.
Well, I knew I wanted to talk to you because when I got the press release talking about the collaboration between you and the Greater New Haven Community Foundation, the Community Foundation for Greater New Haven. You all got together and created the Greater New Haven COVID-19 Community Fund.
Right.
And I mean, I thought that was such an immediate pivot to address an immediate need. Even it felt like even before anybody else was starting to sort of say, how can we be prepared to shift into high gear to deal with this? You guys were already saying, look, we cannot, this is what we do, or this is how we can be of help.
Right. And I think both organizations were thinking that way pretty early on. You know, I can speak most directly to United Way's thinking, although, you know, I'm happy to speak about our partnership with the Community Foundation and share that as well. But I'm just not as informed, you know, about some of their earlier conversations.
Mm-hmm.
But I know for us, because we are so involved with community providers that are working in the areas of homelessness and food insecurity, hunger, we were hearing things fairly early on in terms of the potential impact on our community's most vulnerable residents. And so, you know, we started thinking, I would say pretty early about what some of the possible impacts were going to be. I have to admit, I don't know that any of us fully comprehended what mm-hmm. this would mean. And so that's, you know, become clearer over time. But we knew we needed to be active and be responsive.
Mm-hmm. So, you're not a queen over there. You have a whole full board to contend with. So you have to sort of bring these people together, and I'm sure you have a chair of the board, and you all have to come together and say, this is how we're going to pivot. This is how we're going to support our folks who depend on us for leadership around matters of community issues. So talk a little bit about how that process came about.
Well, we have a great board. They're very supportive, very community minded.
How big is your board, Jennifer?
Sorry, what was the question?
How large is your board?
Oh, I think right now we have either 19 or 20 people on our board.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And they've been very supportive of the need to pivot. Yeah, it wasn't a question in their minds.
Okay. Yeah. All right. And so when you, I would imagine you have to upend some existing programs, like somehow or other the programs that you have in the pipeline or that are laid out already have to sort of what? Pull back, shift.
Right. Yes, both of those. I would say, you know, hit pause on some things.
Okay.
Pull back from other work. And then figure out how you can redeploy resources across the board.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So when you do that, do the people that donate funds, did you hear from them? Did they say, how can we help, or what are you going to do, or like what do you hear when you have these kinds of things?
Yeah, so we've had a multi-part strategy. So we recognized early on in talking to community-based organizations that they knew they were going to have a need for essentially more volunteers. So even in a time when we're trying to obviously follow the governor's rules about being socially, you know, distancing and not being in large groups and really only being out for essential purposes, there are so many organizations and parts of the work that depend on volunteers to make it happen. And we knew that we needed to make sure we had a way to continue to get that word out, because organizations, some of their typical volunteer helpers were college students who are no longer here, right? Because they've all gone back home. Or people who are in more vulnerable populations, like older adults who are retired and have the time typically to volunteer. And so we put out a call pretty early to organizations to say, let us know what your volunteer needs are, either because you're losing your typical volunteers or because the way your programming needs to change, you're just going to need more labor to help you do that. So we put out a request to organizations pretty early on and have kept that kind of live, a live list on our website of volunteer opportunities. So if there are people who are not in a vulnerable group and are healthy and want to help in some kind of way, we do have a listing of specific ways people can volunteer. But then the other thing that we started doing too was letting people know about resources that were available, because we knew lots of people had lots of questions. Where do I find out about this? Or how can I connect to this? Or what's going on in this arena? And so we also have a listing of community resources as well on our website. But then we also were talking about some of the programmatic work we jumped in and started doing. And we heard back from donors and from partners that they were very thankful to have a place to go for that information and felt good about the fact that they knew if they were a donor that their gifts were being used in ways that would help the community.
So when you're talking to these organizations that you serve, some of these community folks or organizations that you provide support to, how are they feeling? Like what's their conversations around some of those tables that you're privy to? Because they're already pretty vulnerable, right? Like they're already stretched to the very end.
So, I mean, we have amazing nonprofit leaders and staff in our community. So first off, I mean, we should just be recognizing them as part of this group of heroes. I mean, certainly our healthcare providers fall into that category. And then I would include people who are taking care of families and individuals in lots of other ways, trying to make sure they're okay. And I think our nonprofit community is amazing. So first off, start there. And then these are really tough times. I mean, I think they're tough for organizations who, as you said, are already pretty close to the margin, right? I mean, the nonprofit business is a tough business. You know, even if you receive government dollars, public dollars for the work you do, it doesn't typically cover your full cost. And then organizations need to do fundraising and seek grants and donor, you know, and dollars from individual donors. And that's hard work. And then this has just added a whole layer of stress because now there's even more work to be done. And it's going to be harder, I think, for all nonprofit organizations to raise money, right? Because people are in tough straits themselves, right? I mean, you see people are losing their jobs and people are worried about the stock market. And there's so much need. So I do think organizations are being asked to do more with less right now, which is why we're really thankful to be partnering with the Community Foundation around this fund, because we're trying to make sure we can get some additional resources out quickly to help address particularly basic needs for people who are, you know, vulnerable populations who are affected by the COVID-19 pandemic.
So what are some of those, who is most vulnerable at the moment around some of these organizations? Is it the food providing organizations, or is it organizations that do some other kinds of supportive things, shelters, or like what is the makeup? What does that look like? What does that community look like?
Well, one of the things we're trying to understand, and this is really by talking to community partners. I mean, that's one thing I want to stress, is that we're really trying to listen and learn from those who are on the front lines, because I mean, they have the real experience about what's going on with people in the community. But what we know based on science and what we're hearing from our partners is that there are certain populations that are more vulnerable to the effects of the disease itself, right? In terms mm-hmm. of older adults, people with underlying conditions. And then I would say, as you think about groups of people, you mentioned one, the homeless population. I mean, I think that is certainly a local population that's particularly vulnerable, both because of potentially their own kind of maybe underlying health conditions they may have, but also even just the situation they find themselves in. I mean, it's, you know, when we're told to kind of stay away from people, most of us who are fortunate enough, that means we're staying mostly at home. Mm-hmm. And when you're not someone who has a safe home to be in, that becomes a much harder proposition.
Yes. So do you see, do you find yourself sort of, Jennifer, anticipating what the needs are ahead of what nonprofits are saying? Because they've got their hands full on the front line. Do you see the United Way sort of being forward thinking in that regard? Like, I think somebody will need this, or let's be prepared to offer this. Do you find yourself being forward thinking like that? Do you have the luxury of time to sort of do that?
I wish I could say definitively yes. I have to say, I feel like over the past few weeks, as this situation has really sped up in ways that I don't think any of us necessarily quite imagined that it would, it has felt like we're all probably being more reactive than we would like to be. Because it's been so in the moment, the needs. That said, I mean, yes, I mean, I do think we've been able to look out ahead a little bit, but it's been hard.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I guess I would imagine that within your own staff, you have to think about making sure that your staff and the people that work for the United Way of Greater New Haven are safe and are following the governor's directives around social distancing. So that adds another level of what? Stress, creativity around right. How you do this work.
I would say, you know, creativity, complexity, and stress, right? Because, I mean, these are people you care about, people I care about, and want to make sure they're okay and as humans. And then it's also wanting to make sure that we can be as helpful to the community as possible. And that means getting the work done.
Mm-hmm.
So it's balancing, you know, both of those things.
So what do your other member United Ways around the state and around the country are prepared to do? Have y'all had conversation about how to move forward? And I know each United Way is unique to the locale of where it resides.
Right, I mean, yes. So each United Way is its own organization, but we have a lot of commonalities. And so I've actually been on numerous calls with my fellow Connecticut United Ways, talking about what our response is, how we can work together. So, you know, not only are we partnering with the Community Foundation here for local work, but then all of the United Ways across the state have come together to create a statewide fund that we're all helping to raise dollars for. And that is a little different than our local fund in that the purpose of the statewide United Way Fund is to be able to provide some resources directly to individuals who are in that ALICE population that we've talked about a lot. So mm-hmm. folks who, you know, ALICE, if people may not know that term, stands for Asset Limited Income Constrained Employed. So these are people who are working who, because of the nature of their jobs, may not earn enough to actually afford what the basics cost in Connecticut. And we knew that there were, you know, lots and lots of households in our region who were in that ALICE category. And I can only imagine that the economic impacts of the virus are going to have many more people falling into that category as people lose their jobs or lose hours. And so we're particularly trying to think about how can we get some financial resources to folks who may not be connected to other social service systems, but find themselves needing some kind of financial support.
I've had members of the various members of the arts community on all week because, they're taking a huge hit right now.
Right, right. You know, and I saw they actually have set up a fund and are using that ALICE.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And so I posed the question to them because I don't think most people really knew how vulnerable the arts community was until this happened.
Yeah.
And now I'm starting to sort of see that in other areas, in other in traditional social setting providers, that I'm starting to notice just how vulnerable people really are because this pandemic has illuminated for us people's vulnerabilities around. I mean, right. I don't think people really thought about waiters and waitresses as work. That's their money. That's how they pay their rent. That's how they pay their
right.
bills.
Right.
What happens when, you're a daycare provider and you can no longer do that. So I find that this pandemic is really illuminating where vulnerable spots are, above and beyond what we already believed or knew.
Right. Right. And I have to say, as I try to think a little more long term, which, like I said, is kind of hard right now, because everything feels like it's right in front of you.
Yes.
I am hoping that as we get onto the other side of this, that we can really step back and have more of a conversation about, as you just put it, the truths about what people are facing and kind of the precarious nature of people's work and financial situations. And I think as a state and as a country, we need to have a hard conversation about that.
Mm-hmm. I think you're right, Jennifer, because it's one thing to just talk about people who are at the margins, people who we know are homeless, people who we know are at the, at or below the poverty level. But when you start to see well-to-do affluent people, have to sort of get in the trenches with everyday other folks, because listen, I don't care if you work on Wall Street or wherever, if you lose your daycare provider when your school closes,
right.
when you can't access the trade or when your office closes, this is a great equalizer.
Right. It is. Yeah. And, there have been a lot of conversations about income inequality and the negative impacts of that. And, not everyone maybe finds that compelling. But I think, as you point out, there are so many ways that this has leveled the playing field for people in terms of understanding challenges. And when I look for something that could be hopeful on the other side of this, my hope is that we can have more productive conversations about how to really address that inequality and create structures and systems as a country that avoid that going forward.
Yeah, in having the conversation with Dan Fitzmaurice, over at the Arts Council, and Andrea, the new arts director, cultural affairs director for the city of New Haven.
Yeah.
That this is really going to change the way that artists do business. So do you think that this will change the way direct social supportive services are delivered? Is there other questions that could be asked? Are there other signs that we need to look at as indicators of what people might need?
Well, I do think there are, I think we may hopefully step back and, like, particularly as you were talking about childcare, I would hope that we would think more about early care and education as a responsibility that we should build into the public sphere in terms of how it's really paid for.
Mm-hmm.
It's not so patchwork and dependent on families. Because it's absolutely essential for, I think high quality care is absolutely one of the best investments we can make in the future well-being of young children. I mean, we know this from all the research. That's a way to get kids on a great start in life. And as you know, we're all being reminded of daily, it's also absolutely essential for parents to have really quality, stable childcare for their children so that they can go to work.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm hopeful that that kind of conversation can be elevated and we can talk about that in a different way. I think that just like there've been a lot of conversations lately, at least I've seen, in the news about whether, the thinking is that there are probably a lot of businesses that may not make it through this. Right. I mean, I'm sad to think, but that may be true for the not-for-profit sector as well. And so by definition, that will likely cause us to have to rethink how some of those services are delivered.
Mm-hmm.
But then I'd say on the positive side, hopefully, is all of this experimenting we're now doing with technology, right? How do we connect with each other virtually? How are we using different tools and applications and people's phones? Maybe it will jumpstart some more innovation in that way that would allow us to work together differently. Even once we can be physically in the same space, maybe there's still some learnings from all these tools and virtual ways of connecting that will be useful for us going forward.
I think so. So does this whole moment of time, Jennifer, allows for you to think about maybe from this we add something permanent to our roster of things that we already do?
Do you mean we United Way, or
yes, the United Way? Like, is there some, do you feel, have you thought? I mean, you're in the midst of this, so it's hard to think about this now. But I would imagine at some point that you think, maybe this is something we should add all the time. This component of some, I don't know what it is, but
yeah, I think that's still evolving. I think it's too early to say, Babs, because we've just really been focused on trying to make sure people are safely housed and that people are getting access to food, with all the complications of people can't be out, right? Vulnerable populations. And so how do you get things to where they need to go when people aren't able to leave?
Talk a little bit about the food insecurity piece. How does that work in a pandemic? Because it's on a good day, on a sunny, beautiful,
right,
everything is good day, challenging.
Right, it is. We're one of the partners at the table in those conversations. The food pantries and soup kitchens and the city and CARE and, there are a lot of different organizations at the table. So I would say from the good news is we've got a lot of people thinking this through and trying to be part of the solution. So that's great. But it is, it adds this whole layer of complexity. So let's just take a food pantry, for example. In a typical food pantry model, you're open certain times. People know hopefully those times and they come and they, pick up food and, they're probably, you didn't have to think a whole lot about keeping people apart or, protections. I mean, maybe you had to limit how many people could be there because of the size of your room in the old days. But now it's this whole calculation because you can't have people, in close settings. You can't have too many people together. I mean, even down to you need to have different kinds of bags or boxes or containers for people to food away in, right? Or to be able now to deliver food to people who shouldn't be leaving their homes. So figuring that out has been a challenge. You know, one of the things that we just started helping with, because this felt like a place where we could help, was hoping to recruit volunteers and then match them to specific routes where they're now delivering food from. We started with a couple of food pantries. The volunteers are now delivering food from the food pantries to the food pantry clients who are in a vulnerable population. They really shouldn't be leaving. And so, you know, we've created routes and have safety protocols for volunteers, and they're out delivering food. So they delivered food for the first time on Wednesday with a fairly small group, kind of as a test run. And I think they're delivering food today to about 80 some people.
Wow.
Yeah.
Holy cow.
Right.
That's a lot of people.
That's something that didn't exist before. So they've had, you know, we've had to create that.
Yes. So does this, Jennifer, does this pandemic give you a whole added dimension to what vulnerable population looks like? I mean, does it give you a different, does it give you a broader, or does it expand the definition of, you know, because I mean, we know elderly people, we know people who, you know, are sick or whatever, but this is a level of vulnerability that who knew this was?
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
Like, I'm probably using that term meaning different groups. So, you know, when I speak about populations vulnerable to the disease, I mean, I'm going off of, I mean, I'm not a scientist or a health professional, so I'm going off of what I read in the paper, you know, and what the CDC says.
Yes.
But I think there's this whole other layer of vulnerability, which may not be so much vulnerability to the disease itself, but vulnerability in the sense that the way people either access services and supports or vulnerable. So, you know, the clients I was just talking about who can't get to the food pantry.
Right.
Right. Or, you know, families that were kind of on the edge before financially who are now vulnerable in the sense that they're not sure how they're going to juggle paying for rent and food and medicine when, you know, they've been laid off.
Yeah. And so, yeah, so the definition expands. And so that's got to be a huge added responsibility to nonprofit organizations that do this work.
Yeah, I mean, I do get the sense, like I said, I mean, I think the providers that I've had the chance to interact with and I and my staff have been interacted with, you know, we're just consistently blown away by their level of commitment to the families that they serve. That said, I think it can feel pretty overwhelming, right? Mm-hmm. So you hear about the family who both parents are sick and quarantined in their, you know, with young school age children, and they're not sure how to make sure the kids have food. So, you know, you hear enough stories like that over the course of a day and a week, and it's overwhelming because you're not quite sure always how to help.
Mm-hmm. So Jennifer, do you all have a legislative team at the United Way? Do you have a lobbying component?
I mean, that's not been a space that we've traditionally been in. What's really interesting actually is before all of this happened, we were in the process of working on our new strategic plan because as an organization that felt like, I mean, it was time to do that. And it seemed appropriate as we thought about our next several years in light of our 100th anniversary. And one of the things we flagged, because we talked to a lot of people about what they saw as needs in the community, was we definitely heard about the need to get, take on perhaps a more active role or explicit role in advocacy work around the efforts that we're involved in. Because honestly, to get long-term change that affects a larger number of people, you have to go to the policy realm.
Mm-hmm. And yeah. You all have amazing data. I mean, part of what makes you so successful is that you all have captured information about populations and organizations that serve these populations.
True. Yeah, we do. I mean, I'd say we have good data from our partners that we work with. You know, we certainly have data that we've collected in through this ALICE report, you know, that we've done statewide every year for the past, you know, we've done three of them. We do it every 2 years. And then actually at the statewide level, because 211 is part of United Way of Connecticut, you know, we have really.
Oh, that's right.
211 as well.
Yeah.
So, and actually I'll just make a plug there. You know, 211 is the number to call if people have questions about possible services. I mean, it's always been that number, 211. I mean, for a really long time, and it's.
Oh, I've used it when I was a young mother and yeah. was looking to access services for my kids around daycare providers, and you know, because I mean, there are daycare providers, and then there are daycare providers.
So they you know, they maintain a database of services, so you can call or you can go online and look for what you need. And their call volume, I was just talking to someone at 211 yesterday, and their call volume has definitely gone up.
I would imagine that it would go up because people who are, and it might not even be people who are necessarily so vulnerable, but people who just don't know how to maneuver systems and work through, you know, all the ways to get information.
And that was going to be actually the other thing I was going to say, because you were asking about possible changes going forward. I mean, I think we knew this, but I feel like this crisis has highlighted it even more, is that it's complicated to navigate all of this, right? I mean,
yes.
It's complicated for people to know what they qualify for, you know, what benefits are available, what they might qualify for, where to go for help. So I think the more that we can figure out how to make that easier for people to navigate and, you know, have more coordination of services so that we can do the most good with our resources, I think that will be important to think about on the other side of this. I mean, we're certainly, you know, we were already doing that in some of our spaces anyway, particular issues, but I think it's just highlighted the need to do that more.
So do you get to have conversation with the providers of education? Because now it's like schools are closed.
Right.
So all these kids have to, I don't know, be, you know, they're at home, right?
Right.
I mean, are you fielding those kinds of conversations? Are you at those tables? You know, does the Board of Ed say, hey, United Way, this is what's happening?
You know, I haven't talked. I mean, I've been in some conversations that had Board of Ed staff who were part of the conversation, and you know, certainly it's my sense that teachers are doing a lot of outreach to their students, checking in on them, you know, making sure they're okay, but then also providing kind of academic instruction. Although how you do, you know, Zoom calls for 4 and 5 and 6 year olds, I really don't know. I mean, let's face it, adults have a hard enough time. Or, you know, in some cases sending packets home. I mean, I do think schools are trying to be creative across the region, you know, so it's not just New Haven, right? It's because we're a regional organization. But I know there have been issues around trying to make sure all kids have technology.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, maybe not the youngest. Like I said, I don't know actually how you would do virtual learning with
little kids,
kindergartners. But for older kids, right, trying to make sure they have technology that they can use, and the schools have been distributing that, and it's my understanding they have the technology to give to kids, you know, if families need computers for them, are giving out Chromebooks. So
I think I saw that too. I saw that on the news. So yeah.
So I think it's families, you know, if they have questions about that, they need to be in touch with their individual school. I assume they all have ways they could reach their principal. I don't know, when you can't call the school office and get someone.
I know, right? But I'm sure that they, like everybody else, are trying to be very creative about how to do this work.
And so, it's a transition, right? I mean, it's going to take time to figure out those new ways of being.
So do you have mental health providers at the big table when you all have these supportive services conversations? Because I would imagine, if you called that 211 data, that you'd see a lot of calls about help, you know, like, help me, I feel anxious, I feel stressed out, I feel, you know, the sky is falling and you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, Clifford Beers and the city pulled together a call, I guess it was last week, with a number of different organizations talking about ways that we could provide mental health support more broadly, you know, for knowing that that was going to be a concern. And one of the things that came up, and I don't know exactly where it stands, but was even the notion of having some kind of warm line that people call. And I know that there was going to be an effort to understand if there was some kind of service or expertise from the state level that could help with that. You know, because what's interesting too about whether it's mental health services or services for homeless or educational services, right, is that you do want to give people the space to develop solutions that work for them and their particular the group of people they're working with. But some of this stuff does not need to be reinvented, you know, 20 times over. So if there's knowledge that exists, you know, somewhere else or at the state level that can be shared and said, you know, say like, this is how this works best. and let us give it to you as your example to work from. I always think that's better than people having to kind of start from scratch, particularly as everybody is scrambling, trying to figure out how to work in this new way. And that I feel like has been part of the challenge over the last couple of weeks, is just people are trying to figure so much out at once.
Yes. And that brings me to my question about how prepared is the United Way for the long haul of this? And I don't even know what that would look like, but I get the sense that, you know, we're not at the end of things.
Right. No, sadly, right? Well, I mean, I guess I could speak, I mean, I'm looking at it as we've got kind of short term, medium term, long term, right? And I don't have completely defined periods of time for those, because it does feel like it's kind of evolving. You know, it depends on the course of the pandemic, right? But I'm thinking, you know, in the next, 2 to 3 months, the work could look a certain way, right? As we're dealing with like this most immediate situation that we're in. I'm hopeful by sometime this summer, we'll be in a slightly different place, and maybe that means we can come back together in person for some things. Maybe it gives us a chance to step back and think a little bit more about what worked, what didn't in the immediate crisis moments. And then to start thinking more purposefully about how to move forward. You know, I think the longer term feels kind of unsettled because it's so unclear right now what's going to happen in terms of the long-term economic recovery, right? So knowing when people will have jobs again and kind of what that whole realignment looks like. And so, I mean, from a nonprofit perspective, you know, thinking also about the impact this will have on state budgets, right? So it's a little hard to know exactly what the longer term looks like right now, but I could imagine financing for nonprofit services will be a big issue.
Because I was going to ask you, you know, when you said that some nonprofits might not come through this, you know, and it didn't occur, that hadn't occurred to me. I don't think people think about that. I think people think that nonprofits just the greater good, people will just do the greater good forever and ever and ever into perpetuity. And that, you know, businesses will close. Like I business probably will not be able to recover from this if this, you know, if this goes out as long as some of the scientists and folks who are in this day to day up close to it are saying. But I don't think people think about nonprofits shutting their doors. And so so Jennifer, when a nonprofit possibly shuts its door, do you walk them through that process? Like do you sort of like, you know, offer as much support as you can? Like this seems like a new yeah. world.
Yes. I mean, certainly nonprofits have closed before. I mean, it's a tough business. And if you look at the data kind of nationally, you know, some really high percentage, like close to 50%, wouldn't last more than, I don't remember, it was some, you know, 10 years or 20 years. I mean, you know, it's not abnormal, right, for organizations to open and try to meet a need, and then maybe the need goes away, or maybe the people who founded it want to do something else. I mean, there are all sorts of reasons, you know, why something starts and then doesn't stay going on and on. But I don't have personal experience through my time at the United Way working with organizations that were shutting down, other than in a couple of very limited cases. And it was much more about helping them think through where their programming could live on. Mm-hmm. You know, like perhaps moving over to a different entity who could take on some of the programming as they were shutting down. So, you know, I'm sure there are legal ramifications and, you know, things if depending on what their sources of funding are, they would have to work with their funders around. So I don't know that we're particularly well equipped to provide all of that kind of advice. But certainly from the standpoint of helping think about where needed services then get picked up, or you know, how we ensure there's not a hole in the community, you know, mm-hmm. that's a space that we can be helpful in thinking through.
Okay. I so appreciate you taking the time to talk to me today. I really do. I wanna tell people,
nice to see
if
you
want to volunteer with United Way of Greater New Haven, they can call.
Actually, they should go online.
They
should go online. So actually, if you go to our website, which is UWGNH.org, we have a coronavirus thing on our top of our website.
I have it right here.
You click on that. And then you can find where you can volunteer across the community. You can find out what other kinds of things organizations might need, like in-kind donations, particular supplies that they're looking for, expertise. You can look at our community resources page, a whole list of things there. And then if, you know, if people feel so moved and want to make a financial contribution, you can do that there too.
Good idea. Thank you so much, Jennifer. And I look forward to having you back on when we can return to celebratory mode.
That will be nice, won't it?
But it is nice to know that the United Way is still very much invested in this community and is very much at these tables where these matters are being discussed and strategized and implement it. So I appreciate your service on this. These are challenging times.
Thank you. And so good to see you.
You.
And I wish you all the best. Stay healthy, okay?
You too. And enjoy those teenagers.
Well, to the degree that they'll let me, yes.
Oh my gosh. Thank you, Jennifer. Have a good one.
Bye-bye. All right, thanks. You too. Bye.
Thank you, Harry Droz. I appreciate you.